Greetings, this is Father Michael. Welcome to St. Dominic's Weekly. A few announcements before our show today. First of all, we continue our St. Monica Novena. We have a wonderful preacher here, a Dominican from Ireland, Father Terence Crotty, who has been leading us in this novena, and an important novena for us. St. Monica is the patron saint of those who have family members and friends who have drifted away from the faith, who know a longer practice, perhaps, or find themselves at a distance or disaffected from the church. And St. Monica, in the course of her own life, had to deal with and confront the fact that both her husband and her son left the church at different times or drifted from the church, and through her example and prayers was able to be instrumental in bringing them back to the fullness of life and faith. And so certainly many parishioners, many folks find themselves in a similar situation with children or grandchildren or relatives, some sort, or friends who they are eager to have approach the church again, to experience the fullness of the life of faith. And so this novena garners that sense of St. Monica's intercessory power and connection for grace. So you're welcome to join us. The novena goes all the way through the feast day, which will be next Monday, the 27th. So the 8 a.m. and 5:30 daily masses, and then on the weekend, 5:30 Saturday, 5:30 Sunday, and the 11 a.m. on Sunday are the novena masses. Also, this coming Saturday is our annual parish picnic. It should be fun and a way to gather the parish together in one wonderful event. There's lots of food and live music. There are the chili cook-off, so dust off that recipe for your best chili, and a pie contest as well for desserts. And then back by popular demand, the dunk booth, the Dunkin' Dominican booth, introducing Father Christopher to the new tradition. So lots going on, and certainly hope that this month when we celebrate St. Dominic in August is fruitful for you. Couldn't be more excited about today's show. It's a part two of New Atheism and Our Faith, looking at some of those thinkers and authors who have purported to say that God's existence is dubious, if not dangerous, to believe or to posit. And so Father Justin and I continue the second part, and we look at this part in terms of finishing up some of the critiques that Dawkins gives, and then to look where we can find Dawkins is actually has some truth, and we can learn from the critique that Dawkins gives before we turn in the last half hour or so to the different ways in which we are able to discover God's existence through St. Thomas Aquinas and through the tradition of the church. So whether you're on the go or taking it slow, many blessings as you enjoy today's show. So a warm welcome back this evening. My name is Father Michael. I'm here with Father Justin, and this is a part two of our Confronting New Atheism and Our Faith in Light of the New Atheists. Tonight we'll be examining arguments against and for God's existence. And we begin with a little bit of a wrap-up from last time. Last, in part one, we talked about the general contours of New Atheism. And to review that for a moment, the figures we're talking about are Richard Dawkins and Hitchens and Harris, and basically this preponderance of publishing that's come out in a popular way. It's a popular kind of movement that's happened in the last roughly 18 to 20 years. And one point I hope you took away from last time is that the new part of the new atheism isn't a new argument or some great insight into biology or to science or into nature at all. It isn't as if these are scientists or biologists who have suddenly had this amazing epiphany of science and saying, this disproves God. It's rather not a new argument, but a new way of arguing. And it's mostly based, as we saw last time, in a kind of attitude against faith rather than rational kinds of discourse. And I think, once again, hearing back from people, I thought it was interesting how we put that in the context of 9/11 and all these arguments and this whole kind of movement as a movement came in the light of religious extremism and a way to kind of explain that, and people taking it, especially these authors using, or if you were capitalizing on that extreme violence to associate all violence with any kind of religious endeavor. So to keep that in mind, it's that sense of attitude, not necessarily a different kind of argument. Here we have Dawkins with his t-shirt saying, "Religion, together we can find a cure." Right, so already argumentative all the way back to see it as a kind of disease, right?
And we might say just one more thing. A couple people were kind of, this was on their minds when they spoke out in terms of questions, and then as you came and saw me at the end of our session last week, is there is also a certain amount of using science as a weapon against religion that also characterizes the new atheists. We'll see that the old atheists didn't have nearly the same faith in human reason and technology, and probably for good reasons. So there is an optimism about science and scientific inquiry and an insistence on the conflict that you'll also find in new atheism that I think also characterizes their kind of fundamental attitude, their fundamental approach.
Nice. To summarize Dawkins as far as we've gotten, once again, here he is with his t-shirts. We are all Africans, so taken to his natural selection and the origin of species. He posits that belief in God is either dumb or dangerous. And on the
he sure does like the special t-shirts.
He does. I think he's got his own. I think he has a side t-shirt business, actually.
he likes novelty t-shirts a lot.
He does. He goes in for that. Once again, part of his popularity is he's a little bit outside the box in that way. But the first aspect of if you're believing God, you're just not that smart, right? You're not bright, right? You're not bright. And used arguments, if you will, or assertions that folks who are religious in any sense or believe in God are non-scientific. He uses arguments from ad hominem, that is, arguing directly against the Pat Robertson types and other evangelists, TV evangelists, to kind of poke fun at them. Seeing ancient myth is just kind of a story for the olden days, so to speak. And straw men putting up arguments that that folks who believe in God really don't hold, to try to easily knock them down. On the other side, that signs of dangerous, that pointing once again, as I said, to like 9/11 and other, looking to history to show how somehow intrinsically religion is the cause of all violence or warfare. The slanting, if you remember the banana, you look at a banana with lots of weapons, and all of a sudden your mind naturally thinks of the ways in which a banana might be dangerous, or might be weaponized, right? as opposed to
bananas. What is this world coming to?
I don't know. As opposed to it as just a sensible fruit filled with potassium for beginning your day. Different ways to look, but slanting or guilt by association, as we remember. So Dawkins spends most of his time railing against religion in terms of invective or these different ways of, we would say, logical fallacies that if you take Father Justin's class at DSPT, little plug, you'll be able to name the slippery slope, the red herring, and so forth. But Dawkins does attempt to make at least one positive argument to say that there is almost certainly no God. And as we look into this positive argument, it reminds me of a story I heard of a professor who was an atheist, and he had a bunch of freshmen gathered together in his class, and he was trying to goad them, to be provocative in getting them to think that any sort of religious dialogue or even religious inquiry philosophically was both dumb and dangerous. And so he says, God doesn't exist, and if you think he does, you're not smart, you don't belong in this class, and in fact, it could be a little bit dangerous. So we're going to have a discussion about that. I'm going to lead the discussion. I'm the professor. I've thought about this a lot. I'm kind of an expert in this area anyway. So he calls, in fact, points to a young lady, a freshman in the class, and says, why do you think God exists? Tell me, give me your reason for existence. And she says, well, you know, I wasn't really prepared for this, thinking about it. It's an interesting question, but I think about my upbringing. Was raised in the countryside, lots of farmland, and there were lots of deer and cows and horses that I came into contact with. And I always had this question. They all seem to eat grass. They eat the same thing. They're fed in the same way. But I noticed that deer excrete in pellets. And cows, their excrete is in like patties. It's kind of flat. And horses, it's kind of like clumps when they excrete. She goes, do you know why that is? And he says, well, I have no idea. I've never given it much thought. And she said, well, I'm not sure how you can consider yourself an expert when it comes to talking about God when you don't even know crap.
Yeah, when I said the joke should be better tonight, you obviously missed that memo.
I got it clear through Father Anthony. I wasn't sure if we wanted to send on that. He gave me clearance for that one. All right.
Goodness gracious. Okay. Dawkins, last week we spent an awful lot of time talking about how Dawkins likes to shoot down arguments and the various general issues that he's engaged with. So today we wanted to, and this would have been last week's, but we never quite reached there, we wanted to give you kind of the central argument of his book, The God Delusion. So as to make it possible for you to have your curiosity satisfied without actually having to purchase the book. You don't really want to support these things if you don't have to. So he does have an argument. It isn't a particularly good one, and you'll see in a moment why. I don't think I'll have to point out to you why it's not a particularly good argument. It doesn't start out so bad. So, you know, with every kind of feature of our world that is typically attributed or explained by God, Dawkins will essentially appeal to natural selection. So when it comes to things like the intelligent design, supposedly intelligent design of the universe, or mind or morality, or the fact that there is anything at all, he believes that there's a good old scientific explanation for that, and his scientific explanation is usually natural selection. So that's step one. Step two, he'll then assert that this alternative natural explanation, usually natural selection, is inherently more probable as an explanation than God. So you have these two options, and Dawkins will say, it's always a better explanation than God. So the question that we ought to be asking Dawkins kind of at this point is, why is God less probable than, say, natural selection or the anthropic principle? And here's his response. The designer hypothesis immediately raises the larger problem of who designed the designer. The whole problem we started out with was the problem of explaining statistical improbability, namely that to have the high degree of evolved organisms and environments and all that we see in the universe has such an intricacy, and elegance, we might even say, that it seems highly improbable that anything like chance could possibly account for it. So we have to explain this statistical improbability, and that's true for us who think the explanation is God, as well as Richard Dawkins, who thinks the explanation lies elsewhere. But here's where Dawkins gets interesting. It is obviously no solution, says Dawkins, to postulate something even more improbable. And why does God need an explanation, according to Dawkins? After all, classic theism, including our own Catholic Christianity, has held that God is the uncaused cause. He is an eternal and necessary being. So God is precisely that being who does not have an explanation. And again, here is Dawkins' rather fascinating conclusion. Any creative intelligence of sufficient complexity to design anything comes into existence only as the end product of an extended process of gradual evolution. Creative intelligences being evolved necessarily arrive late in the universe and therefore cannot be responsible for designing it. God, in the sense defined, is a delusion. Now, I've entitled this slide, Hey, Wait a Minute, because there is a kind of circular reasoning here. So let's look at our little comic, shall we? We know mass creates gravity because dense planets have more gravity. How do we know which planets are more dense? They have more gravity. That's circular reasoning. And, says Dilbert, I prefer to think of it as having no loose ends. Let's just say that Richard Dawkins' argument here has no loose ends. In other words, we are presented with two possible explanations for the world that we currently experience, God and natural selection. Why is God less probable an explanation because of natural selection? Because God, it must be a product of natural selection. Is there something fishing going on? This is classic circular reasoning or begging the question. In other words, my conclusion is natural selection. How I'm going to get to that conclusion is via natural selection. Here it is. Here's where Dawkins' cards are showing. It's not really, the problem is not that Dawkins is a believer in evolution. In fact, the church has come very clearly on the side of evolution being a perfectly fine theory and compatible with our faith. The problem is that evolution becomes a kind of faith unto itself for Dawkins. In the words of Cardinal Christoph Schoenborn, a former Dominican before he became bishop and cardinal, Dawkins is one of those who believes so strongly in evolution that evolution becomes the universal solution to all problems. And that's not someone who simply is looking at scientific evidence and accepts the theory of evolution, but has a kind of overly invested belief in evolution that he terms evolutionism. So the interesting thing is that if Dawkins does appreciate that he posits a very different scenario from classical theism. In other words, he's aware of the fact that the very idea that his God has to be somehow evolved via natural selection is light years away from the classical conception of God. He's aware of that. And if that's where he left it and simply said, I have a different conception of God, then he wouldn't be engaged in any kind of fallacious reasoning. He would simply be not engaging his opponent. They would be talking past one another, as it were. It's when he claims to actually make an argument against God by appealing to natural selection, both as premise and conclusion, notice that natural selection is the premise as well as the conclusion of his argument, that he commits the fallacy of begging the question. And it reveals his adherence to this evolutionism, an unshakable faith in evolution. So you page through the God delusion, and you'll quickly come to understand that this is where Richard Dawkins' faith really lies, in natural selection and evolution. And again, there's nothing wrong but with embracing that theory, but to consider that to be the answer to all questions, really, I mean, as we talked about last time, that can't be scientifically demonstrated. And that's Richard Dawkins' contention all along, is that he's a good scientist, always examining the evidence. Where is the evidence for his evolutionism? It doesn't exist. It can't.
All right, so Dawkins as an ally. So we saw last time that Dawkins' strength really is in critiquing things, or at least that's his mode. It's, remember, not new arguments, but kind of argumentation, or at least attitude. And Dawkins as an ally, although he might be horrified to hear it, another new atheist, exactly, all clear, here we go. He can be actually an ally for us. We can learn something from him because there are several critiques that he does give of ways of arguing for God or aspects of faith which are not compatible with our own Catholic faith. And in fact, by looking at that, and this has happened any time we find someone, an interlocutor, who we perhaps disagree with in terms of their conclusions, we ought not necessarily to dismiss everything they say, because there could be, as we're going to find out, actually nuggets of truth there and ways of looking at the world that help us to greater formulate or articulate what the truth is about something. And so, and simply, we didn't want to simply just leave you with the sense that Dawkins is completely wrong and off his head, period. But even in the God delusion, there are some aspects of legitimate critique that he gives.
And this might be another possible response to a couple of you who asked in one way or another, don't you think that these atheists are insane? Yeah. No, which doesn't mean that we can't think that they're wrong. We can think they're wrong, but this would be another thing is to say there's actually something to be learned from them. They have some good reasoning stirred up with maybe not so good reasoning, and
yeah. So the first thing, and I think we even in our own faith encounter this, is to conflate, remember we talked about guilt by association, or it could even be guilt by our own sense of fallibility. And so Dawkins and the New Atheists have a lot to say about badly behaved people of faith, including many high-profile Christian leaders. And let's face it, it's true that those who have professed religious beliefs, including self-professed Christians, don't always demonstrate the love of God and the truth of gospel in their lives. And even in terms of our own Catholic Church, we know this, right? There's been scandals, and even, unfortunately, in the last few days, scandal, right? It's back, it's raised its head. And we can look at that, and we can say, well, certainly, well, just first of all, admit it's terrible. It grieves certainly our hearts, and as a pastor and a priest, it really is, in some ways, it's just terrible. I mean, it's almost like a dark cloud over your head, where you think, "Oh boy, Lord, mercy, right? We need your mercy in that way." But as a way of arguing, as well as it can undermine, if you will, the witness to the faith, bad behavior doesn't vitiate the truth of the reality in which is posited. I just think of the gospel, just as because we read it last week, as the gospels, we remember that the church is built on, if you will, that community of faith that is expressed by Peter when Jesus says to his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter has an inspired moment, right, where he says, "You are the Christ, right? You are the anointed one."
Yes, he
right?
raises his hand and said, I know.
I know, exactly. Peter's never shy. He's enthusiastic. And Christ goes one better. He goes, "You know what? That wasn't just your thought. You were inspired. That was the Holy Spirit speaking through you. And so I name you Rock," right? In the future, Dwayne Johnson will have nothing on you, right? Hollywood blockbuster matinee idols are nothing compared to what I'm going to do through you and through this community of the church. And the gates of hell will not prevail against it. So for us, as Catholics, as Christians, we take that as that foundational moment of Christ pointing out the vicar of Christ. Literally, two verses later, Jesus says, "I got to go suffer and die." Peter says, "Hey, Lord, let me call you aside. Can I get a private word?" And he says, "Hey," you imagine him just wrapping his arms around Jesus and like, "You know what, now that I'm the Rock, now that I'm on the inner circle, I can maybe come up with another plan of the suffering and death thing, right? You know, let's chat this out. Let's workshop this,
Have
right?
Have you thought of alternative options, Lord?"
Exactly. So he has this moment where he's trying to take leadership and, you know, kind of thing. And Jesus' words are swift. "Get behind me, Satan." Right? So literally within one verse or two verses.
I'm feeling bad for the people who just came in.
I know.
Like,
what
are we walking to?
welcome to the talk tonight. "Get behind me, Satan" is not directed at you. Come on in and find a chair. You're most welcome.
And of course, part of the point is that, you know, Peter needed to allow Christ to lead rather than trying to draw Christ. That's going to be actually a theme that we see in weeks to come. Is part of what we can learn from atheism is this idea that we have to allow God to be God. And there are going to be approaches to God that try to reduce him to something manageable, something we can control, something we can possess, instead of the Lord of the universe who is going to call us to account and continually draw us out of our comfort zones.
Yeah, so in principle, just to make the point, and I think we know it is difficult as is to hear about scandals and folks who have failed, the fact that people who believe in God, and in fact strongly believe in God, fail to follow God or fail those own beliefs doesn't vitiate or make untrue the reality of the existence of God. Does that make sense? In other words, failure to act in ways in which we even want to believe or think believe, or even if we were lying, doesn't necessarily, that's not an argument against the existence of the reality, the truth of the reality. And so Dawkins is very right to critique, but that critique, the conclusion, therefore God doesn't exist, doesn't follow, right? But the critique is good, and it should lead to introspection. It should lead to a sense of prayer, a sense of God's mercy, and even perhaps change in institutional ways in the church. And certainly there's ways that go beyond tonight's talk. But in other words, it doesn't necessarily, the conclusion is, therefore God doesn't exist. Another aspect, and this is kind of combining scientism and faith. Here we have a little cartoon, and there's lots of different arithmetic and calculus on one side, the left side of the chalkboard, and on the right side of the chalkboard, and connecting them is a statement. Then a miracle occurs. And the one professor says to the other, I think you need to be more explicit in step two. And this is that theory of the God of the gaps. There are certain Christian writers, biologists, science, people of faith, who posit that we can find God in science by being the explanative power of things which are quote-unquote mysterious. So, for example, I mean, even now, there's lots in science that we don't know or can't explain. And so Christians will say, well, that's where we have room for God. God is what makes that possible. There's certainly this idea that perhaps there is a kind of unified theory of gravity and electricity and all this. But we don't know it yet. There's still a lot to be explained in that area. And there are those who will argue, well, the whole combination, the unity of these forces of nature, that's where God does. God is, if you will, that force or the unifying property which actually has this collective, reason behind it that keeps everything in the universe going, right? And that is called, if you will, the God of the gaps. There's some gap in our information, something that seems mysterious to us, in which God can be explained. There's God. We can point to God's existence through that.
Yeah, somehow there has to be a point in which there are no physical laws, and that's where God can act.
Exactly.
Right? So one of the most popular versions of this right now is quantum indeterminacy.
That's right.
Oh my gosh, at the quantum level, that really, really microscopic subatomic level, there's indeterminacy. That must be where God acts.
At the indeterminate level. Yeah, because you can know where something is, and when something is, but you can't know them at the same time right now. You can point it with electromagnetics and all the rest. Anyway, so it's like, well, God knows both, right? So God is part of that process. Well, Dawkins argues this is unconvincing and lazy, and he's 100% right. because science doesn't have an explanation doesn't mean that God is the explanatory power for the gaps. When you're talking about science, you should be looking for scientific reasons, right? We talked about Noma last time, right? That sense of different magisterial toppings, or if you will, subsidiarity. Every science has its own causes. We shouldn't be looking for God in principle as an explanation for a scientific cause, a natural material cause. And this whole, if you will, literature around the God of the gaps is quite a cottage industry, and Dawkins is very right to critique it, and we should be very hesitant to buy into or to argue for God's existence based on either indeterminate or unknown aspects of the natural world. Does that make sense? And this is because God uses what we call a classically instrumental causality. The church has little sympathy for the God of the gaps because God works through natural causes, physical laws, just as a writer uses a pen or a king works through officials, called instrumental causality. He can also do things directly. We call those miracles. But by and large, God works through natural means to bring about natural effects. And so if we're in the world to study natural effects, we should look for natural causes. We don't have to look for the divine in every place. When someone says, why is that so? You know, I remember when we were taking freshmen, because God said it. Well, that's true at the ultimate level, but that's not a sufficient, that won't get you an A+ on your science paper.
Yes, and I think we all have some kind of intuitive understanding of this in our lives, right? Is, you know, for instance, you encounter some situation where you really feel strongly God's grace is involved there. Now, God's grace is not made impossible because you can account for the situation in terms of natural causes, right? So you bump into a friend, and you think that there's a special grace there. That doesn't mean that the friend was magically plucked out of where the friend was before and popped beside you, right? They took a train or walked or were about their daily business when you met, right? There's no conflict between natural causes and God also being involved. The God of the gaps gets that wrong because it seems to posit that it has to be either natural or supernatural. And only when there's a lack of natural causality can we somehow understand that God's active there? This is not a good way of thinking about it, says the church and says St. Thomas Aquinas.
Although every time I turn on the light, it does seem like a miracle. I have no idea how to explain the electricity.
And my laptop and my phone are like absolute magic.
It's true.
I can't explain them.
The computer, I don't get it. It works when I push on. So that's the God of the Gaps theory, thinking divine miracle every time I open up my MacBook, right, or my phone. The third aspect, which Dawkins gets right, or at least has critique that we should take to heart, is what we might call biblical fundamentalism. And so he has some reasonable criticisms of this in terms of the overly literalistic readings of the scripture. So, for example, the classic is Genesis, the first chapter of Genesis, the creation of the earth. And he says, Christians believe in talking snakes, right? Who's that HBO person? Bill Maher, always talking about every Christian he has on his show is always like, so do you believe in talking snakes? He just always kind of poking fun at them. As Catholics, do we believe in talking snakes? No, we do not believe
in
that.
Would be scary.
That would be scary.
And snakes are scary enough.
Exactly. In fact, we are obliged not to believe in an over-literalistic account of many things in Scripture, but especially those first texts in the Torah, which are meant to convey the truth, that is the truth of creation, God's involvement in creation, and how we are made in the image and likeness of God, not in terms of contemporary scientific or contemporary historical lenses, right? But through the way ancient Near Eastern peoples would tell stories in order to convey the truth. And so we have to know a little bit about how they do that. And so a critique from a 21st century biologist looking at Genesis and thinking that that's what ancient Near Eastern peoples, how they communicated, isn't that the ancient Near Eastern peoples of long ago are silly or dumb or just, it's that they don't quite get the genre, right? And we definitely don't believe in that. So we have to read the scripture according to the author's intention and to know the genre that's being used, and we can't read historical or poetic texts in a kind of literalistic, contemporary kind of way. So Dawkins ends up talking as if Scripture can be only read as fundamentalists do, and he makes some kind of silly arguments, arguing against Scripture because the Torah stipulated unreasonably harsh punishment for various sins, such as stoning for blasphemy or dishonoring one's father or mother. And of course, we understand the Church teaches that you have to read Scripture in terms of the entirety of the faith, so certainly we don't recommend blasphemy or not honoring one's father or mother, but when children disobey, we don't get out stones, right? We don't get out of the bell, don't you, right? There's this kind of punishments are certainly evolved in that way.
And notice there's actually a lack of historical sensitivity in this kind of critique, too. The kind of critique that Richard Dawkins has is, and even I put, unreasonably harsh. Unreasonable according to who? Certainly unreasonable by modern standards. But if you think of a small fledgling nation as Israel was, things like blasphemy and not honoring your father and mother actually were profound risks for societal cohesion. Yeah. So it's not an exaggeration to say that in that particular context, those kinds of behaviors could be considered, as kind of menace to society. That certainly isn't true for us. So there's kind of historical sensitivity to that. We have to understand there's going to be a different punishment in a different context. And again, that requires that we read the Bible more than in a fundamentalist or overly literalistic kind of way. And again, Dawkins seems to think that there's, if you don't read it literalistically, then somehow you aren't, you're being hypocritical or you don't really truly believe in the Bible.
That's right. So he takes that the way that fundamentalists read the Bible is the only way one might read the Bible when the preponderance of those who do believe in the Bible don't read it that way. So there's a little bias. But it is instructive for us not to get, in a sense, pulled in by that overly literalistic way of reading the Bible. So we have to ask ourselves in terms of what kind of faith. For Dawkins, the source of all his criticisms and kind of animus against religion is his view of faith, which he sees as opposed to reason, blindly following some kind of ancient text or otherworldly ideology without critical evaluation to thought or consequence. And once again, Dawkins does a good job of pointing us away from false understandings of the faith or faiths that pit us against reason or science, but to an understanding of faith that is complementary to reason. And this is the view that we're going to find when we look at the Church Fathers, Augustine, Catherine of Siena, Thomas Aquinas, and the Catechism. So that's where we're headed tonight. Deep dive into proofs for the existence of God.
Yes, and a few of you might have thought, okay, we're listening to Dominicans talk, so they're going to spend a lot of time on the five ways. That's not untrue, but we're going to try to. But we're going to try to do a lot more than that because, you know, hopefully you probably have heard the five ways from Father Justin to Father Michael before. So we're going to try to expand the scope of
six ways, seven ways,
six ways,
eight ways.
And that's actually fairly easy for us because Richard Dawkins actually does a lot. He only spends about three pages on St. Thomas. He spends a lot of time on other proofs. And I put those in air quotes because a lot of them are not proofs per se. Either Dawkins realizes that and sometimes he doesn't. So the first couple things we wanted to point out are going to be basically things that Dawkins addresses and says people will often consider this as proof for the existence of God, and they're not. And he's actually right again. We don't want him to be right too often, but he is right sometimes. So one of the things he'll point out, and this hopefully will make sense to you, subjective experience. There are many who will appeal to some kind of private or personal experience that they've had as their grounds for believing in God. Subjective and first-person experiences are powerful for those who have them, and so that's a very legitimate move. But notice that it doesn't translate very well to somebody else. They don't typically constitute objective grounds by which other people can be convinced of God's existence. So in other words, they're personal reasons, but not proofs per se. So you've been to Medjugorje or Lourdes or wherever, you've experienced an extraordinary kind of a vision or a feeling, and you're absolutely 100% convinced as a result of that experience that God exists. That's wonderful. Dawkins is actually going to be a little bit less generous than I am here. I think that's wonderful, but you're not necessarily going to be able to convince anybody who hasn't already had that experience, and that's going to be part of Dawkins' point.
I know a certain novice master, when he has chocolate, sees candy, and he bites into it and says, God exists.
That's right. Well, like St. Paul, he's immediately transported to the seventh heaven.
That's right.
So, boy, are we going to get it when we go back to Priory.
He told me to tell that first joke, so I've got to get him back.
You guys talked a lot without me being present.
I got to be
careful of you two. Dawkins does actually more than rule out subjective experience, though. He's actually a lot less gracious than I've implied. He does tend to ridicule it. So he quotes his fellow new atheist, Sam Harris, very approvingly, basically saying that religious experience is a kind of hallucination. And the only reason we don't recognize it as sheer nuttiness is because there are so many of us who share this common insanity.
If
there were less of us, then we'd recognize it for the hallucination or madness that it is.
If everyone's crazy, no one's crazy.
That's right. It's got a low-grade insanity. In other words, religious experience is really discounted. And although we can appreciate that religious experience is never going to be the objective proof that's going to necessarily convince somebody across the table from you who hasn't had that similar experience to, in a way, shove religious experience entirely off the table and equate it with a mental disorder is very ungenerous. And we might say, again, there's really no argument made for that. It's an assertion. It's not an argument. There's no actual reason given for that, except that Dawkins and Sam Harris et al. Think that it's either dumb or dangerous that you believe in anything religious at all. Another thing that's trotted out as a kind of proof that, again, Dawkins is good at identifying, it's not really proof at all, is the idea that, there are just so many people in the world that have some kind of religious belief that religion must, in fact, be true. And Dawkins is perfectly right to insist that majority opinion is never going to be determinative of truth, although it can be indicative of it. But we know of more than a few cases in history where the majority has been in virtual agreement on a particular issue, and they have been quite wrong. So we can appreciate, again, Dawkins pointing out that just because there are a lot of people who exist in God, or it has been typical of society up until the 20th century, is not actually definitive evidence of any kind. And if you remember from last time, Dawkins also has an explanation, although it is admittedly sketchy and nonspecific, for this kind of universal religious testimony or universal religious inclination that humankind happens to have. It is a side effect of natural selection, right? Natural selection is the key to everything. Another thing that you might think would be a good proof for God's existence is miracles. So here we have a nice picture of, or rather not a very nice picture of, the miracle of the sun at Fatima. That's all that was able to be captured on camera. Dawkins admits that he can't really explain miracles like the miracles of the sun, because you basically have 50,000 people who all agree on what they saw being something extraordinary and not explainable by natural reason, and not the kind of thing that you could have seen if you were anywhere but Portugal on that particular day. He doesn't necessarily have an explanation for that, and yet he's going to say anything is more plausible than to admit that it's a miracle. And the idea here is that miracles might be signs, but they're certainly not proofs for God's existence. Really, in a way, you have to already have welcomed the possibility of God's existence, and you have to already have, in some sense, been open to the idea that something could be a miracle in order to see it as such. Otherwise, you're not going to tend to see it as a miracle. And Dawkins is very good at reminding us that there are alternative explanations, whether it's mass hallucination or a kind of shared delusion, or, you know, sleight of hand. We could have, you know, kind of the old magician pulling the rabbit out of the hat. We don't know how it happens, but we don't necessarily want to leap immediately to the conclusion that it was God. So miracles can become tricky as a kind of proof in the formal sense of God's existence. We already have to be open to an existing God in order to basically accept something as a miracle.
Yeah, so it goes to, I don't know if you've seen the movie Song of Bernadette. It opens with that Franz Werfel quote, which is made by many people. It's a common phrase, but for those who believe, no miracle is necessary. For those who don't believe, no miracle is sufficient. Right? And so, in other words, miracles aren't the reason that we believe, but they support what we believe. They can encourage us, they can inspire us, but at the heart of hearts, they can't actually be a kind of proof that will carry the day unless we're already open to that reality of miracle. Once again, not to say that, I mean, our faith is based on a miracle, on the resurrection of Jesus Christ, so certainly it's not unimportant, but when we're specifically talking about proofs for the existence of God, they can't carry that. Why? That's not what they're about. So.
And this might also answer the question, certainly is a question that I thought about when I was a child, a young adult, is, you know, why doesn't God just come down and do some really great miracles and convince everybody? Why do we have to do this the hard way? I think the answer is actually this, is that, you know, even if God did that, we would still say, oh, no, that was just coincidence. That was...
Well, God has done it, right? In many ways.
Yes, and the miracles that he... in fact, this is part of the scripture. Remember
Lazarus.
Lazarus, mm-hmm. The old rich guy who, you know, ends up going to... not the good place. You know, he wants to come back and, you know, give his brothers a warning, right? And what does Abraham say? Abraham says, if they haven't already figured it out, if they already have me and the prophets, and they don't have it, they're not going to have it. So, you know, coming back, someone even rising from the dead isn't going to make the difference.
That's right.
So
that's right.
This is the inherent limitation that miracles have. And it's not that miracles don't have a role. It's that there already has to be something going on in somebody's heart and in somebody's life. And if they're not prepared, if you are Richard Dawkins, you're never going to see the miracles that are around you, even though they are actually there.
Dawkins then takes a little bit of a, he's not exactly the most logical, like a systematic thinker, but a little bit of a parenthesis to go after C.S. Lewis. And when you go after Lewis,
Michael, Father Michael is not a happy camper.
Not a happy camper. So, because he kind of misses the point. So this is, I'm going to work up on this one. So there's the very famous C.S. Lewis that, called the Trilemma, where, and this is speaking not necessarily the existence of God, and we'll get back to that, but he's talking about Christ and the incarnation, and almost mirroring what Dawkins and others might say about who Christ is, C.S. Lewis begins with this quote, "I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God." We've heard this before, right? We've known this as familiar. This is something that as even Dawkins can at least say, well, he might have been, you know, a nice guy, a good moral teacher. Lewis goes on to say, "That is the one thing we must not say. A man who is merely a man and said the sort of things that Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman, or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to." A very powerful passage from C.S. Lewis, and it's often called lunatic, liar, or Lord. Jesus, by claiming to be the Son of God, either has to be a lunatic, crazy, he's got to be lying and manipulating, or he has to be who he says. There's no middle ground.
But isn't there a fourth alternative?
And this is what Dawkins tries to create. Not quite sure why, but Dawkins suggests that Lewis has neglected a very obvious, to him, fourth possibility. Couldn't Jesus have been just honestly mistaken? He just kind of made a mistake.
I woke up and I thought I was God, but then I realized I wasn't.
I've got some beachfront property in Nebraska for you. So I'm not sure how maybe I can't get into Dawkins' mind, but maybe he's trying to like call him kind of soft. His real answer in terms of the kind of mistaken, honest mistake fits into maybe low grade lunacy, and maybe Jesus doesn't need to be in the padded cell. But if you claim to be God and you're honestly mistaken, you're a little bit crazy. You're not quite in touch with reality. That's what lunacy is, right? You're a little bit not in touch with the reality of the situation. So I think he kind of reads that wrong. He kind of misses the point though. Because the point is not a formal argument for God's existence, but Lewis is pointing out that when it comes to Christ as the Son of God, we must reject him as evil or mad or even mistaken, right? Even if it is mistaken, there's just no scenario where we can think of Jesus as just a moral teacher. So Dawkins' proposed alternative doesn't really affect the point. The point isn't whether God exists. It's can we take Jesus in a kind of patronizing way? Nice guy, moral teacher, right? Even if you propose a kind of, he's kind of a less of a lunatic, he's kind of just like a low-grade crazy, still doesn't affect the point that he's either one of those three options in various stages. But once again, it has nothing to do with God's existence. And this is another key that I think Dawkins is missing in the whole discussion of Christ and of God, is that he goes to, we believe, as the incarnation, and he could have gone to the Trinity in the same way. We're talking about the great mysteries of our faith, and this is not where you start with, right? When we begin RCIA, which we will begin in a few weeks, we won't start. What things you won't hear in the very first class are the Trinity in three easy steps, or here is the fullness of the mystery of the incarnation, right? Right? Because the first words of the Bible are not, right? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. The Word was God. It's in the beginning there was God, right? It doesn't start with the angel coming and saying, you are to be the mother of God, right? It doesn't begin with Hail Mary. It begins within the beginning, right? So we can't jump to the end. So he kind of goes in. So this missing key is, suppose we need or possess part of a novel or symphony. Someone brings us a newly discovered piece of the manuscript. This is the missing part of the work. This is the chapter on which the whole plot of the novel really turned the main theme of the symphony. Our business would be to see whether the new passage, if admitted to the central place, which discovered claimed for it, did actually illuminate the parts we seem to pull together. And something like this we must do with the doctrine of the incarnation. Instead of a symphony or a novel, we have the whole mass of our knowledge, and the credibility will depend to the extent on which this doctrine, if accepted, can legitimately integrate into the whole of Mass. It is much less important that the doctrine itself should be fully comprehensible. For example, we believe that the sun is in the sky at midday, not because we can clearly see the sun directly, but because we can see everything else. So, in other words, the idea of the great mysteries of faith aren't held because we understand them in terms of comprehensibility, but that they make everything else comprehensible. They give us that path, right? And so, once again, Dawkins kind of missed the point on his little diatribe and invective against C.S. Lewis, and I would not have it.
Now, how many of you have experienced what Lewis is talking about? You have these mysteries of the faith. You might not be able to explain the Trinity very well, but man, it really illuminates your life. How many of you experienced that? That is really the case for me, I have to say. This is one of the reasons why I don't have very many moments of doubt about the faith, because the teaching of the Church is just so illuminating for me that there's so many different dark corners of our experience that now make sense, you know, through the person of Jesus Christ. So this might not be a formal proof as such, but certainly I think it's powerful evidence.
Yeah, and Lewis even says in parallel about, like, say, the Eucharist, which is interesting, not Catholic, but he talks about entering into that mystery. He says, Christ doesn't say to his apostles at the Last Supper, take this and understand it. He says, take and eat, right? So enter into the fullness of that mystery of being nourished in that way. How certainly we can talk about how we understand it, but if you first attempt to understand without that context, you're going to be you're going to be off on the wrong foot. Okay. Ooh, Girard. Now here's your guy.
Now we're going to talk a little bit about the work of René Girard. How many of you had a chance to meet René Girard or see him? He was down at Stanford for many, many years, so he's actually was a Bay Area resident.
Yeah, maybe say a little bit about him personally for folks
who don't know. Well, René Girard was a literary critic, an anthropologist more than anything else, but he had kind of this grand theory of how violent cycles actually worked. So he did a lot of research into scapegoating mechanisms and how we can actually use violence to regulate violence, although it's an inherently unstable sort of situation. But he actually looked at a number of cyclical situations of violence in literature as well as in different societies, and concluded that the gospel actually is the definitive unveiling of violence. So this is a really interesting theory, and I bring it up because, of course, one of the contentions of Richard Dawkins is that religion is not only violent, but it is the source of violence. And in many ways, René Girard is saying the exact opposite, and I think in a much more convincing way. So he's arguing about Christianity, and his argument is going to be very specific to Christianity, to the gospel, that the gospel has definitively unmasked violence for what it is, and that it has led us to appreciate the nature of innocence and the dignity of many victims of violence. In a way that really did not exist in the ancient world. So the ancient world did not value compassion and mercy the way we do. They did not take the part of the victim. In fact, it's rather the reverse. We'll see that as we get into discussions about Nietzsche, as he will actually articulate a kind of morality that harkens back to pre-Christian tragic ethics and morals, and show how strength and victory was what was prized. But it's actually with the gospel that we look at cycles of violence. We appreciate the very meaning of what it means to be a victim, and an innocent victim at that.
And the scapegoating, you don't want to, that's a key.
That's right. So there's a kind of a dynamic in cultures that things start to degrade. A community starts to squabble, starts to experience chaos and unrest. And one of the ways that this chaos and unrest is overcome and order is restored is by finding someone you can blame for it all. This is a scapegoating mechanism. And we see this in a number of scenarios, in fact, even in the 20th century. Who are one of the big scapegoating groups of the 20th century?
Jews.
The Jews, yeah. Mm-hmm. So for those of you who don't understand necessarily the role that the Jews played in Nazi ideology, for instance, the René Girard's work on the scapegoat might be quite illuminating. There was, we find one person to focus all our anger at. I'm no longer angry at you. We're both angry at this guy. And we pile on all our problems and we blame him for or her for everything, or this small group of people. It has to be someone who is not strong enough to defend themselves, or else they're not a very good scapegoat. And we're able to kind of get rid of all those feelings and restore order because we all have a common target for our blame.
In religious life, the scapegoat is otherwise known as the prior. Very effective.
That's hard to argue. So it is with the gospel's insistence of Christ's atoning suffering on the cross and his complete innocence at the same time that we really are able to appreciate the plight of the victim and the very mechanisms of violence that are in place here. And we have to unveil those mechanisms before we can overcome them. That's one of the principal benefits of reading the gospel for René Girard, is to see how violence is unveiled through the death of Christ on the cross. So here's a quote from one of my favorite books of René Girard's, I See Satan Fall Like Lightning. That's a nice title, isn't it? Grabs you. It says, our society is the most preoccupied with victims of any that ever was. Even if it is insincere, a big show, the phenomenon has no precedent. From one country to the other, the sudden turns of fortune are different, but they cannot conceal the true origin of our modern concern for victims. It is quite obviously Christian. Humanism and humanitarianism develop first on Christian soil. And I have to tell you, if you want to pick up a book, I See Satan Fall Like Lightning is hard to put down. And at the end of the book, he's made an extremely good case for the kind of revelation that the gospel has of the nature of violence and how that revelation has allowed us to overcome violence, at least to the extent in our world that we have. So we now have to go back to Dawkins' point. Has religion essential links to violence? Well, it depends on which religion would be René Girard's answer. In many cases, the answer is yes. And we can remember David Bentley Hart's quote, it's perfectly possible to recite the Nicene Creed and deplore Aztec human sacrifice at the same time, right? Religion did control and regulate violence in its primitive forms. By instituting sacrificial rites intended to address individual and communal guilt, and prescribing punishments so to head off cycles of violence that could be perpetually infinite and eternal. In other words, you do something to my family, then I retaliate against your family, then you retaliate against my family, then I retaliate, you know, there's no end to that. So religion was a kind of mechanism for regulating violence. In its primitive form, it did not overcome it, but institutionalize it. It's with the gospel that we have a paradigm shift so that Christ himself teaches us how to overcome violence through through love. We overcome hatred through love. Remember, turn the other cheek? This is what Christ is talking about. And of course, most powerfully, Christ himself literally takes on the role of victim. Pretty neat stuff. Back to you.
Back to me.
Let's talk about dirt.
Let's talk about dirt. Let's get dirty. Like a pig and slop. All right, so another aspect is the fact of sin or original sin, and this is Chesterton, another favorite of mine, and he says that the modern masters of science are much impressed with the need of beginning all inquiry with a fact. So you begin with facts. The ancient masters of religion were quite equally impressed with that necessity, and how do they begin? They began with the fact of sin, a fact as practical as potatoes. Whether or no man could be washed in miraculous waters, there was no doubt at any rate that he wanted washing. But certain religious leaders have begun in our day not to deny the highly disputable water, but to deny the indisputable dirt. Certain new theologians dispute original sin, which is the only part of Christian theology which really can be proved. The strongest saints and the strongest skeptics alike took positive evil as the starting point of their argument. If it be true, as it certainly is, that a man can feel exquisite happiness in the skinning a cat, then the religious philosopher can only draw one of two deductions. He must either deny the existence of God, and this is that evil, you know, if evil exists, how can there be God? Or, as all atheists do, or he must deny the present union of God and man, as all Christians do. There's a failure, right? There's sin in the world. Some new theologians seem to think it highly rationalistic solution simply to deny the cat, right? No point at all. So this goes back to the overly optimistic, you're talking about science being overly optimistic in the new atheists, as opposed to the masters of suspicion, as we'll see later on. And this is, once again, that the fact of original sin is going to be both atheists and theists alike will acknowledge it, and it's actually helpful to say even those who don't believe in God see sin as a reality. We actually have less in common with those who are kind of indifferent to the reality of sin, who don't explain the cat, if you will. All right.
Okay, now we're going to get into a little bit of what we promised, some more formal arguments for the existence of God. And we are hoping to get through at least two of the five ways tonight. We'll see how we do. So, can we prove God's existence? This has been a question lurking in the background. Of course, Dawkins believes that we can't, but we can at least somehow arrive at the conclusion that God is extremely improbable, and therefore it is rather dumb of us, if not insane of us, to try to accept something like God. But that certainly isn't the tradition. That's not our faith. Is there a way of knowing that God exists, even if there are certain aspects of God that are only open to us through our faith? Now, it depends on it seems like so often the answer is, it depends. It depends on the kind of proof, according to St. Thomas, whether you think you can prove God's existence or not. There are two different kinds of proof, according to St. Thomas and the classical tradition that goes back to Aristotle and before, demonstratio propter quid and demonstratio quia. I know that you will cherish these terms and, again, roll them out at parties to impress your friends and family. Here's the difference. A demonstratio propter quid reasons from causes to effects. So when we have really good information at our fingertips, we're able to predict the future. For instance, like predicting the weather, although I think St. Thomas would say it should be better, on current conditions. We have the principles. We know the current configuration of things. We can then reliably predict what's going to happen next. This is demonstratio propter quid. And it gives us a very definite answer. So if we know all the forces of the weather that are happening now, we're going to be able to give you a really good weather report for tomorrow. And it's going to be very specific. Demonstratio quia works in the opposite direction. It works from effect back to cause. So pretend like you are hit over the head. You are walking through a park and all of a sudden, wham! Now what possibly could have done that to you? You look around. If there's someone with a big 2x4 laughing and running away, you have a pretty good idea of what might have just happened. Or you might look up and see that, you know, maybe an acorn fell from a tree. But you aren't going to blame it on the earthworm in front of you, right? Why not? Why wouldn't you do that? Because the earthworm isn't up to the task of hitting you over the head, right? So there, and that is a very silly instance of demonstratio quia. We reason from effects back to possible causes. Another example would be you're trying to get through a door and you cannot open this darn door. It only opens up a sliver and then it stops. Well, you don't know exactly what's blocking the door, but you know something is blocking the door, right? You've once again done a very simple demonstratio quia. You've reasoned from effect back to the cause of that effect. Now, the cause is not going to be completely known, right? There's a range of causes, but there are going to be, again, causes that you can rule out. So there is going to be some kind of definite knowledge that you can get if you are engaged in this kind of reasoning process. This is the difference between these two different kinds of proof. Yes?
And when you see the cartoon?
Yes, and we love this. What do you mean it just happened? Didn't we discuss cause and effect? So this is not perhaps well understood anymore, and yet it's based on very firm principles. The fact that causes and effects are constantly linked, and that causes have to be sufficient to cause their effects, right? There, just by looking at the effect, we can actually rule out certain things as possible causes, because you can't give what you don't got. So, again, the earthworm can't be what hits you over the head, and, you know, there are going to be only certain things that can stop you from opening a door. When we undertake to prove God's existence, we are doing exactly this, reasoning from effects, which are created things, to their possible cause, God. Because God's effects are never proportioned to God himself, our knowledge of him in this way will be very imperfect. And so this is one of the reasons why revelation becomes so important, because really philosophical knowledge is going to give us a lot of information, but not nearly as much information as we want to have a personal relationship with God. We need scripture for that. And yet, even though our information from philosophical reasoning is imperfect, it is still very real.
Yeah, so there's a kind of basic circumspection that Aquinas has. We shouldn't expect, when we argue philosophically for God's existence, to get anything more than just God exists, right? And so, in fact, Thomas will say, unlike perhaps others who argue for God's existence, that there is more that we don't know about God than we do, right? There's more that we don't know about God. Why? Because we only know the effects of God, right? That demonstratio quia, that it exists. So when we're, in terms of setting our expectation for the five ways, I think sometimes people approach the five ways and they expect to argue for a God that we have our faith in, the God that we worship and have that personal relationship with, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's not what Thomas, this is the very beginning of the approach, and it's just arguing that this, if you will, supreme being, or this uncaused cause, or the different conclusions that we'll get to exist. So if that sets our expectations, that gives us, once again, we know more about what God is not than what God is, and what we can argue to, although completely true, is just the tip of the iceberg.
That's right. Another thing to keep in mind if you ever crack open the Summa Theologiae, I know that's a lot of your favorite table reading or right before bed, like Flannery O'Connor. But I remind my students all the time, probably so often they get sick of me saying it, is that when it comes to a proof for God, the five ways are actually just the first step. So you get that in the second question of the Summa. And that really is just the start. We really don't conclude to a real conclusion about God in a more substantive way until we get to the end of question 26. So it's the whole first part of the Summa that actually has to be taken together. The ways are just the opening salvo, as it were. So we get a lot more information in the coming questions, and we start to get an actual portrait of God philosophically. But it takes St. Thomas quite a bit of time to do so. So these ways indicate that we have a kind of necessary being who is somehow has the knowledge and power to create the world. And then we're able to, from concluding to that existence, say something more about what might apply to God in terms of his power, his goodness, his love, and his life. In this brief little article where Aquinas puts forward his proofs for the existence of God, he does, as he always does, trot out a couple objections, potential objections to his position. And the first and most powerful is the existence of evil. If God, who is infinite goodness, existed, it seems like there should be no evil in the world. The second possible objection is the world doesn't need God to explain it. Everything can be explained either by nature or human reason and will, so there is no need to suppose God exists in order to explain these things. Notice that the first is about evil, which is a big problem for most theologians. We'll talk about that a little bit tonight, a little bit tomorrow, a little bit next week, and then a lot in our last session. And he seems to actually have anticipated Richard Dawkins, because this is Richard Dawkins' problem, is, well, doesn't the world explain itself? And Aquinas is going to say no, but only in a particular way. And the particular way will be these particular five ways. Aquinas also actually does, I think, give us a very nice answer to the objection to God's existence on the basis of evil. He basically says, it is part of our faith that God is infinitely good, and though he allows evil to exist, it's only to produce a greater good. So, for instance, he does allow us to commit evil acts, but part of that is that he wants us to be able to love him, and part of authentic love is being able to make mistakes along the way. Now, I find it absolutely fascinating Dawkins' response to the problem of evil. He doesn't think it's a problem. So the very idea of theodicy, that's the name for the challenge of the problem of evil to God's existence, the very problem of theodicy is, for him, not a problem at all. It is very easily overcome. Here's how he puts it. It is childishly easy to overcome the problem of evil. Simply postulate a nasty God. Or if you don't like that, invent a separate evil God, call him Satan, and blame his cosmic battle against the good God for the evil in the world. Or, a more sophisticated solution, postulate a God with greater things to do than fuss about human distress. Now, one of the reasons that this quotation is so telling is because this has been done many, many times. And Christian theologians have actually done a really good job of showing why dualism, having a good God and a bad God, doesn't really work. Satan isn't an independent bad God, by the way. That's not who Satan is. Satan is a creature just like the rest of us. And before Christianity, a God with greater things to do than fuss about human distress was exactly their picture of God. So again, Richard Dawkins might have some homework to do. Now, Dawkins is absolutely right, at least on this point, that the problem of evil is no problem if you get rid of one of the two ends. That is, if God is both truly beneficent and simultaneously omnipotent, then you do have a bit of explaining to do. But if you get rid of God's goodness or you get rid of his power, there's really no problem, right? We can explain evil with a God that is good but can't do much about it, or we can explain evil by a nasty God who happens to be all-powerful but wants to see us suffer a little bit or a lot. And there all are a lot of problems with classic dualism. So this is the kind of position, for instance, that St. Augustine I first found attractive and then ultimately had to reject. Manichaeism and various Gnostic dualisms, the fact that there was a good God who tended to be spiritual and beyond everything, and a bad God who trapped us in this material world, this actually ended up being a quite absurd kind of system to maintain. And again, Dawkins suggests them kind of off the cuff as if they were not problematic, and as if the problem of evil was easily solved. For him, it is. I find that absolutely fascinating, but perhaps doesn't point to, again, his being conversant with the tradition that he is engaging.
All right, the big moment.
Yes.
The five ways. So just to, before we jump into the particular five ways, just a little bit of an overview that we've covered. First of all, the five ways are the first foray into showing God's existence. They are demonstrations from effect, not from the cause. We don't know the cause. We have no access to that, but for the effects we see in creation. And in fact, just the first question of 26 that take us all the way through to a fuller aspect of what we might say about God. In the proofs, they all have four steps. They all begin with Aquinas noticing something about nature, something that's observable, something in the material world. And from that observational datum, Aquinas says that this is an effect, something else. This can't explain itself. There's something else that must explain X, Y, or Z. He shows that cause that's there needs to be there, else the effect wouldn't be there. And he does this usually through the regression to the infinite, and then is able to come to the conclusion that the only proper cause which explains what we're seeing right now is what we call God, what we name as God in a philosophical way. So does that make sense? So in terms of the flow, you observe things, you say that can't happen on its own. The only proper cause to keep this going needs to be actually exist, or else this wouldn't exist here, but we see this exists here, and this is this phenomenon is happening right before us. Therefore, the fact that this phenomena is happening means there is something upholding it in existence, making it do what it does right now, and that's what we call God. So that's the flow of argument for every one of the five ways, and each way comes from a little bit different aspect of what the phenomena are, what the observational data are. The first way from motion, and here we have a series of dominoes, and just to read it, this is what Aquinas says. These are his words. The first and most manifest way is the argument from motion. Whatever is in motion is put into motion by another, for nothing can be in motion except it is in potentially towards what it's in motion to. So therefore, it is impossible that in the same respect and in the same way a thing should be both mover and move, that is, should move itself. For whatever is in motion must be put into motion by another. If that by which it is put into motion be itself put into motion, then this must needs be put into motion by another, and by another, and by another again. But this cannot go off to infinity, because there would be no first mover, and consequently no other mover. Therefore, it is necessary to arrive at a first mover, put into motion by no other, and this everyone understands to be God. Right. So we'll break this down a little bit in terms of what he's talking about. So the key moves that are made. No thing can be put into motion of itself, but requires another to move it. And here he's relying on the definition of what a motion is. If you've ever thought about it, a definition has to explain something. And I remember a philosophy professor starting the class by saying, give me your definition of motion. I'll give you 10 minutes to do it. Without using in the definition the word motion or change, because that's you can't define something by using the word itself, right? It's really hard. In fact, it's almost impossible to do. And the one who has a key insight into this are the Greeks, who come up with this distinction between is and can be, potentiality and act. And so the definition of motion is going from a state of being can be to being is, right? So to use the formal phrase, it's the reduction of potency into act insofar as something is potential. That's the classic definition the Aristotelian have of change.
Again, something to take to parties.
Exactly. Another something for the water cooler. I just reduced some potentiality into act, and it was pretty sweet. So the point is you can't be both can be and is at the same time. Those are mutually exclusive things, right? Insofar as it can be, it's not. Insofar as it is, it just can be, it is. It's actualized. You know, potency and act are two, if you will, opposites in those ways, related to each other, but can't be both then.
Just to give you an ordinary example, you have a bottle of bleach sitting in your laundry room. How many of you have a bottle of bleach sitting in your laundry room? I know we do. That bleach isn't actually doing anything at the moment, right? It's just sitting there in the bottle. But it could do something, right? Bleach has actual properties and powers. So all you really have to do is basically throw a nice cup of bleach into your cycle of whites, and it will whiten and brighten, or so say the commercials. The bleach is in a state of potentiality when it's in the bottle. You pour it into your laundry where it's actually doing something, and it's in a state of actuality. Now, notice, to get it from potentiality to actuality, there has to be what? Yes, that's absolutely right. You have to do something. And this is essentially what Aquinas is getting at, is there has to be some kind of external mover whenever something is in potentiality to get it into actuality. So motion, and by motion he means both motion and kind of change of any kind, requires this kind of mover from the outside.
That's right. And so the argument goes that there has to be, in other words, there since nothing that we observe in the world is self-actualizing, then there has to be, there's a kind of continuum of both actualization and potentiality, potentially coming to act, and that can't go on forever, or else what? Or else if there's no beginning, there's no end, but we see the end. We see it happening right now. Therefore, there has to be something which is self-actualization itself, something which is not part of, if you will, this material string of things, but it allows change to happen. So,
What name would you give to that something?
Maybe a God.
What a good name.
So God, from the sense of the unmoved mover, is going to be the first idea. That sets the world into motion, but self not in motion or not in change. And all of the different ways are going to come. In terms of the second way, do we want to do the second way, or should we take questions? Maybe we'll come back and wrap up. So here, I'll put a bow on this and we'll take questions. The point here is that in terms of potency and act, can be and is, that God is the explanation for why things that can be are, right? Because we could either be or not be, and all the different ways of argumentation point from observable reality that have this mixture of potency and actualization, and that they rely on a being or something, and not just a being, but something outside of being, which just is pure actuality. That's what God is, pure actuality, existence itself, the very to-be of existence that makes everything else come into being, not in terms of time, and we can get into that next week if we talk about objections and things, but right now the fact that I'm standing here talking to you, the fact that you're able to sit and listen, means that something has to hold us in existence right here and now. We don't simply explain ourselves, and that's what we call God. Okay. That's the first way. I mean, you might have questions. We're going to continue on this next week, but we'll open it up for questions in our last 10 minutes, as is our one. And if you say the questions, I might repeat it for the sake of our audience at home for clarity. So questions, Michael. Yeah, so the question is Dawkins representative of the others, or do the other new atheists have maybe more interesting or other kinds of arguments?
The long and short.
They're not. Dawkins is actually, I think, the best representative of them all, and I think the fact that his book was so popular, he comes at a very popular level.
Certainly not all the arguments of the new atheists are exhausted by examining Richard Dawkins, but they tend to trot out the same sorts of concerns and types of arguments, and they tend to quote one another very approvingly, which I think is bad sportsmanship myself, but I guess I quote Thomas Aquinas all the time, so I guess it's okay. But
yeah, so no, Dawkins is, I think, the best representation of them. Yeah. Yeah, biologist. So Dawkins is a biologist.
Yeah, and let's keep it present tense because he actually is still alive.
Yeah. Oh, is, yeah. So I'm thinking of Hitchens. Even Einstein believed in God as an impersonal being. Have you ever heard that that's how you believe in God, Einstein? Yeah, so the way, is that a question? So you're saying that you started believing God was impersonal? Or?
Say Einstein was an atheist?
Uh-huh. I'm sorry.
Actually, Dawkins does essentially make that claim. He discusses Einstein's quote unquote belief and says, "Look, if you are believing in a God that is so impersonal and so diffuse throughout the universe, you really don't believe in God. You just basically believe in the universe." I think even Einstein would find that a bit reductionistic, but that's his way of explaining away a lot of scientists who have some kind of belief in God. He basically discounts that sort of belief as being not robust enough.
That's right. But to be clear, though, it's not really possible from a philosophical way to get to the full idea or the full revelation we have in terms of the personal God that's given to both the Jewish and Christian groups. So just to say that. Yeah. Matt.
So Dawkins seems to put a lot of faith in natural selection, which is biological.
Mm-hmm.
But underpinning biology, and I'd like to think I came up with this, but this was actually from a Father Anselm homily I heard years ago. Mm-hmm. But underpinning biology, you still have carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, you have sort of the physical sciences. Has anybody ever sort of attacked Dawkins saying, well, you're not explaining where you know, those carbon atoms came from. You know, they natural selection relies on life, and life relies on, you know, those raw elements. Natural selection can't explain where carbon came from.
I'm glad you raised this question. We have kind of simplified Dawkins a little bit because we can't talk about everything he wrote. But he does address this, what might be called the cosmic constants. So for instance, the background radiation, the rate of expansion, and a whole bunch of other different constants about our universe that make molecules at all possible. Certain constants get rejiggered, and all of a sudden you don't have enough cohesion to bring things together. Or the other way, they become so impacted and massive that, again, they can't have, there's nothing like the diversity of atoms and molecules, much less life. So he does account for this, at least according to his own principles, and he spends a great deal of time talking about the anthropic principle, which is the idea that our universe seems to be well-suited for life. I would almost said designed for life. Oops. He would not say that. But he actually appeals to possible worlds theory. So instead of saying it's just, you know, it's miraculous chance that our universe happens to be configured this way, he basically says, no, there are an infinite possible universes, and our universe is just one, and our universe happens to be the one that has life in it. Aren't we lucky? That's more or less his approach to these sorts of physical issues. He spends a lot of time discussing what's called the anthropic principle and basically saying that, again, it's a statistical improbability until you realize that there were infinite chances out there, and we're just one of the chances that happened to get it right.
Yep. Oh, and then, yeah.
I haven't seen it. I highly recommend it. And especially if you haven't read The God Delusion, I picked it up like years ago and tried to read it, and it was so painful. like literally, it's so painful, so I would recommend you forget about it. But if you listen to that debate, it also really helps to like follow all of your. So I just highly recommend it. It's like only like an hour and a half or something.
Nice. So.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great insight. And what Dawkins seems to miss is there are certain actually important presuppositions to the very idea of natural selection, which we'll get to when we talk about Aquinas' fifth way. So natural selection already presupposes there is an awful lot of order and that there is a direction in which natural selection will inevitably lead things. Richard Dawkins doesn't seem to radically question that, which is, I think, a pity, because he might be a little bit humbler in his claims about there being no God if he were a little bit more critical about his own science, which, again, my contention has been all along that that's where he puts his faith. So he's not quite as critical as he would like you to believe.
Yeah, exactly. That goes to the kind of general, almost naive optimism they have towards science in the day and age, right? So they don't give the same critical apparatus to their own, if you will, presuppositions and principles that they do when looking at religious kinds of arguments. So yeah, so there's that irony. Yeah. So one and then two. Yeah. Sure.
It's just certain principles don't necessarily align with the Bible or the church, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that there's, I just want to know the perspective on the question, on that natural selection and evolution, right? It's that the principles exist, right? You study the principles, but it's not necessarily that you can't get it.
Yeah. Yeah, so the question is about faith and science, and to be a good scientist, do you have to kind of check your faith at the door, or to be faithful, do you have to kind of say, well, we can believe most of science, but there's things we just kind of shy away from, and we covered it in terms of last talk as well, but to say it again, in fact, there are many examples where because of faith and presupposing there is an intelligent designer and a God, that actually makes someone a better biologist, a better scientist, right? They're not only not mutually exclusive, but there's actually a compatibility there. The person who came up with the Big Bang, a priest, right? And look at the thing. And so he said Mendel with a hybrid, the modern hybridization and geneticist was also a priest, Mendel, right? And
was
so
Copernicus,
yeah, Copernicus, yeah. So the whole revolutionary thing. So yeah, not only are they not incompatible, or you have to kind of tiptoe around. In fact, there's a way in which I think we could be a little sidebar presentation, but you could show, I think, how definitively people of faith actually, because our world can tell us about who God is, and that's the basic presupposition of these five ways, that studying nature actually will give us greater insight into the Creator. The same way someone looks at art, and you can learn more about the artist by getting deeper, and people who love an author will read, and what will they do? And they'll reread, and they'll reread, and they become almost forensic in their analysis. I mean, TV shows these days are movies, right? Someone was telling me about the whole series and saga. I mentioned the superhero things. There are people who just like study, watch these movies over and over again, looking for little clues and whatnot and everything. And so there, if you will, faith, I mean, taken loosely, but the idea that looking at something which is created or some kind of art will lead you to discover more about the artist as a general principle is, I think, at work when it comes to science. The greater a biologist has an appreciation for a personal living God, the more they're going to throw themselves into their work as a biologist to discover what this loving, living God has done at this, you know, really cool level in biology and so forth. So.
To complement what Father Michael has actually said, there's also a feature of Christian theology that respects that the natural world has its own proper integrity. So there are alternative religious approaches that really do block, I think, the approach to science. But Christian theology has insisted that creation has been well ordered by God. And so there is an order to discover. And that has actually inspired science. There are some very nice Catholic historians of science that you might be interested to pick up. One of them is Pierre Duhem, D-U-H-E-M. And another is Father Stanley Yockey, who I think just passed away recently. Mm-hmm. I hope that's true, because if he's not dead, then I'll be very embarrassed when this becomes a podcast. But anyway, they're both quite wonderful. And I think they make a very powerful case that modern science is actually a lot more positively linked to Christian theology as a precondition for how it's been engaged in the West.
In fact, last time we were talking after we stopped recording, but Francis Collins, who had the person who mapped the genome and DNA, is a Christian, and I just my personally with a last name like Collins, it's just a matter of time till he's Catholic. But don't tell him that. but no. But so anyway, so and he talks very and his book on that is very much robust in terms of pointing to God's existence. So another way to go. We'll get one more question. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I feel like often atheists are saying, "Oh, kind of Christians have this sort of many people that believe because you were raised that way, or because you were kind of surrounded by that." And you touched on that earlier.
Sure.
But if you kind of take that away and you're just looking at, so I guess my question is twofold: if you're just looking at how to have a conversation with somebody, let's say as an atheist, and you're coming at it from a rational mind. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Excellent question, especially when it comes to this. It's kind of the, you know, we talk kind of philosophically and abstractly about does God exist, but I'm sure for most people here, the intellectual stimulation is perhaps motivated by or kind of the rubber meets the road when it comes to talking with family and friends and interacting in your workplace with people who might think, like Dawkins or others, that you're either dumb or dangerous for believing these kinds of things. And so those conversations, certainly in terms of prudence, you know, lots of different principles that might be at work. And we will, I think, in our last class, talk about how we might do that in a practical sense. But just to give it just a few kind of anticipatory kinds of reflections. The first thing I think we have to do is we always come from an approach of hearing where the other person's at, so that sense of accompaniment. So when someone comes in as a priest, obviously I can't hide the fact that I'm a priest if I have it, right? And often we'll say something very strongly and negatively, and what I can't do is personalize that negativity, you know, even if it comes across personal, just to meet people where they're at. So if someone's dismissive or thing, and so I usually say, well, tell me more. Tell what's at stake for you, to try to get what's really at issue for them as a common point to be able to perhaps either bring your own sense of experience, your own kind of understanding. I know this was in a very personal way. My first encounter with folks who were Christian but not Catholic was eye-opening for me, because I was given a view and insight into the scripture and Christianity from folks who weren't Catholic. In fact, some of them very anti-Catholic. And it actually helped me in having to meet them where they were at and try to say for myself, this is in high school, like, why do I believe what I believe? It set me down an intellectual path, sometimes we call it apologetics, of being able to give explanations for the faith, that helped me in my own Catholic faith. It wasn't as if I was trying to prove, I was like, oh, now I've got to convert all these non-Catholics. It was like, oh, maybe they have a point. Maybe I should, you know, maybe it kind of led me to sharpen, in a sense, what I truly did. So it was self kind of identification with the truth. But then also, the very process of journeying with someone else, if we're open to it, can help, because oftentimes the truth is gained or discovered in relationality when you're walking with someone. If you're trying to just convince someone of an idea, that can be very difficult, because we tend to just psychologically have our position, you know, from our upbringing or whatever, where our and then kind of like dig in, right? and you're not going to prove me, you're not going to change me. If the whole point isn't, I'm not going to prove or change anything, but here's where I'm at, here's my experience, and to begin to kind of proffer that kind of thing, it can be the way that I put it is,
we want to win the soul.
Yeah.
We don't necessarily want to win the argument.
Yeah.
We only want to win the argument if it wins us the soul.
That's right.
And some people can be very, very focused on the argument and then go away saying, I won the argument, but they've completely turned off the person they're talking to. It's much better to listen and not even get to the argumentative stuff and actually form that relationship that Father Michael was talking about. It's much better to do that and continue to have an ongoing discussion and let people come to draw their own conclusions rather than to make it an intellectual fight. Because so often it's not intellectual. Yeah. Sometimes it is, and it's good to be, you know, to have those intellectual tools in our toolkit so we can clear those away. But so often it's something else going on. So often, you know, winning the argument and winning the soul are two distinct activities.
And I think a lot of the time, to underscore that, most of it is kind of clearing impediments. Right, when people say, I guys remember just classic things, oh, you Catholics worship Mary or something like that, or you theists believe that God is, you know, this you know, big, you know, God the Father is, you know, an old man in the sky with a beard kind of thing. Just like, kind of, people have these kind of ideas that are popularly conceived, and it's just, no, that's not exactly what we think about God. So it's oftentimes it's just removing stereotypes can be half the battle in terms of starting that conversation. So we'll talk a little bit more, but those are some of the principles of that.
Was there one more? Yes, yeah, I didn't. Oh, yeah, don't want to forget you. Outcome That's a great question.
Yeah, it is. It's a good one to end on. That's all the time we have tonight.
No. Let me say just two preliminary things, because I don't think I can do justice to your question in any reasonable amount of time, because it's such a good one. But the classical definition of evil actually included kind of two categories, two genera, if you will, what we call natural evil and what we call moral evil. Evil itself was described as privation. And what privation is it's not simply an absence of something, but it's an absence of a good that should be there. So, for instance, a natural evil, an example of a natural evil and evil in general, a privation, would be, for
blindness.
Instance, blindness, or you know, your poor little dog only has three legs because you know something happened to it as a rescue. Dogs are supposed to have four legs, and obviously it did have four legs at one point, but it's missing that leg. That would be a kind of illustration of privation on the natural level, and it occurs all the time. Moral evil has its own privation, but the privation occurs in the moral agent. That is, your intention or your deliberation or something about your action is deficient, and so that's the privation in the moral sense. So there were these two kinds of privations, these two kinds of evils, and natural evils were acknowledged very, very early. So there was an understanding that this kind of, we might call it cruelty, although there might be a little bit of an anthropomorphizing there. But yeah, the fact that there are certain things that you would think nature would have, and yet nature is full of cycles that mean that individuals of a species are, you know, eaten by other species, that there's a certain cycle of replacement, and that sometimes entire species go extinct. Yeah, I think we can acknowledge all of that, and yet I think the fundamental intuition, at least from the theological level, is that there's a kind of beauty and diversity of the whole, which makes sense of all these natural evils and puts them into context.
Yeah, so it does. It falls. Your question falls into that, the problem of evil, which is, I think, the most difficult question that theologians have to and philosophers have to account for. And we'll get into a good. It'll be a good segue for when we talk about evil next time, because the way that, in terms of explanatory powers, we say that those who believe in God, those who are theists, do really have to explain the problem of either evil, whether it's a natural evil or a moral evil. Those who don't believe in God have to explain everything else. And on that note, next time. God bless you.